The merit case docket, and beginning with the case of Patricia Gerald versus the Commonwealth. Mr. Hallahan, you're on the telephone at this time, is that correct?
Yes, sir. Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning. And Mr. Shanville, you're ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Well, then I guess we'll finesse your sign-in, Mr. Hallahan, but we'll get this thing going so that you can go on to your next court appointment, which I understand is in just a few minutes. So the court is ready when you are, and do you care to reserve any time for rebuttal, sir?
1 minute, Your Honor.
1 minute, all right. We're ready.
All right, thank you, Justices, for accommodating the telephone conference, telephone hearing. I was appointed to represent Patricia Ann Gerald in the Alamore County Circuit Court. I didn't do the trial. I was appointed for the purpose of the appeal. And there's 2 points. I want to argue the second point first, because that's the shorter one. The trial court made a finding that the Alamore County General Circuit Court is in Charlottesville. Charlottesville was specifically carved out of property in the center of Alamore County for the city of Charlottesville.
Doesn't the Act of Assembly from 1888 cover that, though?
It could be argued that, Your Honor, and I understand that's out there, but I was relying on the Fitch case from 1896, which was after that, where the appellate courts upheld a proper prosecution for perjury in the Augusta County court would be in the city of Stanton. The city of Stanton is located dead center of Augusta County, just like Charlottesville located dead center on Alamore County, so the facts are exactly the same.
Well, counsel, doesn't that establish that this could have been tried in the city of Charlottesville, not that it had to be tried in the city of Charlottesville?
I understand the court's position on that. The Fitch case is all I've got.
I understand why you said it would be the shorter of the two arguments.
Yes, sir. Your Honor, the second argument I would like to make, the assignment of error, is in reference to the actual conviction itself. The reason that I bring that up is because we've got a witness at the scene who saw my client at the incident exit the driver's side of the vehicle, but did not see who was driving.
Well,
we have an officer. Go ahead.
Counsel, was it the driver's side of the vehicle or the driver's door of the vehicle? Because it seems to me that that's a pretty significant distinction.
I'm reviewing it briefly, Your Honor. It said he saw her get out of the driver's side. That's what I have in my report. I based that on the transcript. If I made a mistake on that, I have to check the appendix.
You can continue. I can find it.
Okay, I'm looking at page 128 of the appendix. I saw the driver get out of the car.
Identifying the person as the driver, wouldn't that give rise to an inference that they got out of the driver's portion of the car?
Yes. After you saw her get out of the driver's seat, yes. That's on page 128. But as I said, years of a police officer and a defense attorney, you've seen multiple times where people switch drivers, switch pretty quickly after an incident or when the officer's trying to pull you over. So what I'm getting at is he might have seen her get out from behind the driver's seat, but that doesn't mean that she was actually driving. By the time he turned around, they could have switched. What I'm trying to get at is the fact that that's not an absolute. It's similar to if an officer stops you on 64 for going 90 to 70, that's reckless driving. It's jailable. Just like driving on suspended, people come into court and say, hey, look, I wasn't going 90, I was only doing 75. The officer's radar showed 90, the court goes with that. I would say that a 90-mile-an-hour radar reading is more reliable than a man saying somebody was driving just because he saw them get out of the driver's seat after an accident. And no one's charged with perjury for lying in a speeding case if they say deny going as fast as they're charged. That's my point. And then you've got her statement to the officer admitting to driving. Now, the Fritter case talks about the jury instruction where it talks about falsity has to be established by two or more witnesses. And we would argue that potentially there's only one witness and maybe none. She was not under oath when she told the officer she was driving like she was in court. So if she was lying to the officer, at best she can be charged with false report to officer or obstruction, which are misdemeanors under 460 or 82.1. We would say that him seeing her get out of the driver's seat is not substantial cooperation. And that's my point on Fritter, that you can't, we don't know beyond a reasonable doubt, either the language or the Commonwealth, that she did lie, because we don't know the baseline facts to establish the truth.
Would the two-witness rule apply in the case of a confession or a guilty plea?
A confession, I would... The best I can answer that one is saying that's not what we have here. We have someone who fought the case and denied driving. And well, based upon her defending herself, I think she was not driving. She was charged with perjury.
Well, don't we have an out-of-court confession?
We do. We have her telling the officer that she drove. We have her admitting to the officer that she was the driver. But as I said, when she gave that statement, she was not under oath or under the penalty of perjury.
Well, most of the time when one gives a confession, that's you're not under oath.
Yes, sir, I understand that. I just don't see how this is different. An officer stops somebody for 90 to 70. The officer says, why are you going so fast? I'm late for work. They get to court. I wasn't going 90. I was only doing 75. They're not then charged with perjury. I've never seen that. And I'd argue this is a misdemeanor driving on suspended, just like a reckless driving by speed would be. I'm trying to match the facts here.
Doesn't the standard of review present a problem for you, though? We would need to find that the conclusion reached by the court was wholly without support, and that simply is not the case, especially if we wind up viewing the facts in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth. Would you agree with that?
Yes, sir. I understand that's a high hurdle for us to get over. The facts are what they are, and my client wanted to appeal, and I believe that it warranted filing a petition for appeal, and we were appreciative that you granted the appeal. But my argument is that's all I've got.
Counsel, I would ask you to comment on the Commonwealth's law of the case argument. And I guess my question is the fact that this is a perjury case, does the law of the case argument not apply as directly as the Commonwealth suggests?
I don't understand the question, Your Honor.
Well, the Commonwealth makes a law of the case argument that because you did not appeal the driving on suspended, it is now established as fact that your client was driving on suspended, and therefore that's...
I understand. Now, I would reject that theory. The elements of the two charges are completely different. Whether she drove on suspended or not doesn't matter as to whether she committed perjury or not. If a fact finder found that she was driving on suspended or found that she was not guilty of driving on suspended because of reasonable doubt, that still doesn't change the evidence. Someone still saw her get out from behind the driver's seat. An officer said she still confessed. So it doesn't matter what the trial court ruled on guilt or innocence on the driver's suspended. The facts are the same for the perjury, and the elements are all different.
Well,
I would reject the Commonwealth theory on that.
Well, and I'm not saying I accept it either, and I'm going to have some questions for Mr. Chandeville on that. But my question is, if we accept that it is conclusively established by the conviction that she was driving the car, and our decision in Neff suggests that that's what a conviction establishes, whatever the predicate facts are, then doesn't that provide proof that her testimony that she wasn't driving the car was false? I know we're in this odd perjury situation, which may change the analysis, but I mean, if we accept that it is established, and I'm not saying that we're going to, but if the law of the case doctrine dictates that she was in fact driving the car, isn't the evidence sufficient to convict her of perjury?
I would argue that it's not, because they're different elements. And because of one trial court's opinion or one jury of 12's opinion on whether she drove or not, that doesn't have any bearing on the actual perjury. It's the same as if someone's convicted of the 90 and 70, that doesn't mean they committed perjury when they said they thought they were only going 75, which would be an infraction instead of a misdemeanor. So I reject that and ask that the perjury, the court find that the perjury case stand on its own, irrespective of any outcome on the draft defendant.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further, Mr. Hallahan?
No, sir. I believe the Commonwealth wants to be heard. I can reserve my minute.
All right. We're there then. Mr. Shanville.
May it please the Court. Chris Shanville for the Commonwealth and this appeal. On the sufficiency of the evidence to prove perjury, the evidence in this case is very strong and satisfies the two-witness rule, more than satisfies the two-witness rule, because we had three witnesses testifying in this case as to the falsity of Ms. Gerald's statement that she was not driving. On the date in question, we had Mr. Welch, who testified that he immediately got out of his car, and that word immediately is on page 142 of the appendix. And as he was getting out of his car, he looked in his rearview mirror and saw Miss Gerald getting out of the driver's seat. So there was no time for Miss Gerald to switch with her daughter, to switch seats, and thus his testimony, he concluded that she was the driver. And that constitutes one witness. And then the two police officers also testified that she admitted to them that she had been driving. So that satisfies the danger that the two-witness rule is designed to protect against, which is the danger of, in a kind of he-said-she-said situation, pulling one of the two parties in that situation into court and charging them with perjury, which is the example that Mr. Hallahan proposes when someone's pulled over for going 90 and 75, and you have the defendant testifying and then the police officer testifying. In that case, you wouldn't satisfy the two-witness rule because you would only have the officer's word versus the defendant's word. We don't have that situation here.
Well, let's change the hypothetical and say the officer comes up and in fairly common practice says, "Do you know how fast you're going?" "Yeah, I was going 90," and then testifies at trial 75. Is the two-witness rule satisfied then, even though it's the same officer?
If that presents a more difficult question than we have in this case. The two-witness rule is designed to protect against a case where you have oath versus oath. In that particular case that you propose in the hypothetical, you would have the defendant's oath that she wasn't driving versus the officer's oath that she said she was driving. So I think in that situation, you would have oath versus oath, and you probably would have a two-witness problem. But in this case, we have two police officers, both of whom came in and gave their oath that she told them that she was driving, plus Mr. Welch's oath that she was driving. So you have three witnesses as opposed to just the one.
If you didn't have Mr. Welch, would you have a two-witness problem?
I don't think you would. I think the two police officers testifying to two separate statements made by the defendant as to her driving satisfies the two-witness rule because you have the two oaths of the police officers versus the one oath of Ms. Gerald. As to the threshold question as to the law of the case doctrine, the law of the case doctrine holds that when a party declines or refuses or for whatever reason chooses not to assign error to a ruling at one stage of the proceedings, then that party cannot challenge that ruling or that factual finding, whatever the case may be, on a subsequent stage of those proceedings.
Well, and it's essentially a preclusive effect doctrine. And so I wonder if in perjury it's different because other preclusive effects, not law of the case, such as collateral estoppel and res judicata. The example is, as argued, I say I was going 70. The officer says I was going 90. I'm convicted of going 90. I don't appeal the speeding ticket. The Commonwealth then charges me with perjury. Am I precluded from arguing that I wasn't lying?
I think that you would need to appeal the perjury conviction. I mean, the underlying speeding conviction.
I'm talking a separate proceeding, though.
Right.
So straight res judicata, I'm automatically guilty of perjury because the trier of fact. I mean, I would lose every perjury. The Commonwealth would win every perjury case.
Right. So
where the defendant denied doing the crime.
I think the distinction in that case, one, there's the two-witness rule that the Commonwealth would run into in attempting to prosecute a perjury case on those facts. So that's part of the protection provided by that rule. Secondly, I think the law of the case doctrine talks about when the party fails to appeal or assign error to an error at one stage of the proceedings, and then at a later stage of the proceedings attempts to attack that earlier finding. So I think an example you proposed, you have two separate proceedings, kind of on analogous tracks, but two separate proceedings, and I don't think that that's what we have here.
But res judicata as a claim and issue preclusion doctrine would hold that same parties, same issue, can't be relitigated, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Doesn't that take us down a path where there are unintended consequences? There's a pile-on charge of perjury on every case that the Commonwealth wins?
In the case where you have separate proceedings, yes. But I think that given the posture of this case is different. It's sufficiently different that you don't run into that problem, where the case starts in general district court and then is appealed up to the circuit court. And the same trial, the same proceeding in circuit court, the trial for perjury occurs, there was every opportunity for this defendant to avoid this preclusive effect by simply assigning error to both of those rulings, and she chose not to.
The law of the case theory that you propose here is not essential to your side.
It's not essential to my argument, Your Honor, because the evidence is so strong and does satisfy the three-witness rule.
And if it was, you'd be in trouble in the next argument we're going to hear.
Correct, if it was, but then I think the evidence is equally strong there. Moving on to the venue question, and Mr. Hallahan argues that there's no carve-out that to state that the Albemarle County Courthouse at that property is carved out such that it's not within the city limits of Charlottesville. But that argument is really beside the point, because as the trial court found, the courthouse is within the city limits of Charlottesville. But that still leaves open the question whether or not, despite being within the city limits of Charlottesville, there is some statutory grant of jurisdiction over that property to Albemarle County. And as Your Honor has alluded to earlier, that 1888 Act of the Assembly, which rechartered Charlottesville from a town to an incorporated city, did grant joint jurisdiction over any county property within the city limits of Charlottesville to both Albemarle County and to the city of Charlottesville. And if you read further in that Act of the Assembly, the very next section discusses what type of property the General Assembly was contemplating and discusses the county courthouse and the county jail. So it's clear that there is joint jurisdiction over this property that's owned by Albemarle County, but within the city limits of Charlottesville. It's clear if you trace the use of the phrase joint jurisdiction and the phrase concurrent jurisdiction throughout decades, even centuries of case law, and dictionary definitions as well, that those definitions are used synonymously and interchangeably and overlapping. And for those reasons, when the General Assembly said joint jurisdiction, it meant the same thing that legislatures mean when they say concurrent jurisdiction, which is that a party can choose which of the two jurisdictions to bring a case in, and that court can exercise jurisdiction without any sort of assistance or without any sort of coordination with the other jurisdiction. If the court were to hold that that sort of coordination were necessary, it would kind of bring proceedings in these kind of circumstances to a halt, more or less, and that just cannot be the rule in this case. Opposing counsel cites the Fitch case, which of course is distinguishable because the issue that's before the court in this case was not before the court in Fitch. The Fitch court examined the inverse question. And even more so than that, unlike here in the Fitch case, there was no place in the code where it was otherwise provided by law that the county would have joint jurisdiction over property within the city limits of Charlottesville. We do have that here, and that's what makes this case different, and that is what makes venue appropriate in the Albemarle County Courthouse for offenses occurring within the Albemarle County Courthouse. Unless there are any further questions for the Commonwealth, I'm happy to rest on my brief and ask the court to affirm.
Hearing none, we thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hallahan?
Yes, Your Honor. The only thing I would add in my response is that the two-witness rule with the radar case, if the officer had a trainee in the car and they both witnessed it, would that open a floodgate for perjury prosecutions if either speed the officer clocked at or specifically said they were going at different speed? That's the concern I submitted from here, Your Honor.
Very well. Anything further?
Bill, Your Honor.
All right. Very well. The case is submitted. The tradition of this court is to step down and greet counsel at the end of each merit argument. We'll forego that this morning, given that you, Mr. Hallahan, are some distance away.